This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, coming to you Tuesday, July 13th, 2004. In its first weekend, it torpedoed all predictions and earned $23.9 million. And producer Harvey Weinstein expects that it will gross over $100 million. What is this phenomenon? Fahrenheit 9/11 by Michael Moore. Today on Taking Aim, we discuss Fahrenheit 7/11, convenience store protest, and the limits of liberalism. There has been much criticism in the bourgeois press of Fahrenheit 9/11. Some focusing on distortions. And in reaction, Michael Moore stated, "There is not a single factual error in the movie. I'm thinking," he said, "of offering a $10,000 reward for anyone that can find a single fact that's wrong." For reasons for which we don't agree, the bourgeois press has come up with inaccuracies. Today on Taking Aim, we approach Fahrenheit 9/11 with the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, facts that neither Michael Moore nor the bourgeois press dare touch. Ralph?
What we're really discussing here is a film which evokes categories that touch our hearts and our minds with respect to the enormity of the crimes that have been visited upon the American people and their victim populations in the Imperium, the areas where there are resources and cheap labor to be secured, and in which the U.S. military, as has been the case historically and through every single administration in power for the last 150 years, in pursuit of cheap resources, cheap labor, and imperial domain. And always in that regard, wars have to be fought on pretext, and each pretext depends upon a contrivance, and no single conflict of any magnitude has occurred without a lying rationale based upon false flag operations. What we have documented over 3 years on Taking Aim with 9/11 as the predicate. 9/11 is the means through which we understand our past, our present, and the intended future on the part of our rulers. The power of Fahrenheit 9/11 is that it touches upon this evidence, and it touches upon the ways in which people have suffered as a consequence. The limitations of the film are its inability to understand, its refusal to examine in a fashion that might be equated with what the Jesuits call invincible ignorance. Michael Moore knows, but in many important respects, he chooses not to know.
In fact, in some, the film becomes a conservative film rather than the protest statement that it sets out to be. As Moore comments about 9/11, quote, "It was the largest foreign attack ever in the United States," end quote. And he refers to attacks 8 years earlier and says the terrorists did it. That, and also his attack, his setting up of the Saudis, are what we will discuss today on Taking Aim. Ralph, let's deal first with the largest, the official fiction that Michael Moore buys hook, line, and sinker.
Well, the examination of 9/11 starts from the premise that the Bush administration, and the Bush family in particular through its venality, is tied to the Saudis financially. And that is specific to the Bush family, and the Bush dynasty, and the Bush commercial interests, and Harkin Energy, and Arbusto, and ultimately the Carlyle Group, all of which are ascribed almost exclusively to the Bush family, as if the Bush family invented the relationship of U.S. imperialism to the Saudi royal family and the Saudi monarchy. And indeed, this history is tracked by Michael Moore with a specific purpose, to show that the Bush family contrived to fly the relatives of Osama bin Laden out of the United States in the immediate aftermath of 9/11. And then he flashes on the screen, compellingly and dramatically, the pictures of the hijackers, 15 out of 19, he tells us, Saudis, The Saudis did it. The Saudis did it. But Bush and his family, tied commercially and financially to the Saudi royals, have focused on other issues and allowed the culprits to get away.
Let's look at the supposed hijackers. It was revealed very soon after the FBI stated that these were the 15 hijackers that 7 or 8 of the supposed World Trade Center hijackers had been found alive, including 2 of the alleged Flight 77 hijackers, Adnan Zakaria Bukhari, Captain Saeed Al-Khamdi, Captain Abdul Rahman Al-Omari, Amr Kamfer, Marwan Al-Shehi, Amr Abbas Bukhari, who had died a year previously when the small plane he was flying crashed in Florida. And this was documented not only by Islam Online on September 17, 2001, but also by the BBC. In fact, on September 20th, the L.A. Times quoted Robert Mueller, director of the FBI, and they said he had twice been forced to admit on CNN that, quote, there is no legal proof to prove the identities of the suicidal hijackers. Ralph?
Well, the alleged hijackers, as has been reported on Taking Aim and documented over a substantial period of time, do not appear on the manifests or on the passenger lists. The 19 hijackers with their Arab names are nowhere to be found on the manifests and on the flight lists. In fact, when you total up the passengers that are ascribed to these airlines, there is not a single Arab name amongst them, nor is there any evidence that the people who are supposed to have hijacked the airplanes had any relationship to those flights, were anywhere near them, let alone on them. That is a documentation which has been sustained not just by the BBC, but by investigative journalists in the established press and indeed in the 9/11 investigative work of so many of the people who have been engaged in documenting the fraudulence of the official fiction. But in particular, the very absurdity of the notion that a small royal family in Saudi Arabia, long clients of American imperialism, long completely dependent upon that relationship since Franklin Roosevelt established the House of Saud in control of Arabia for the single purpose of facilitating U.S. domination of the oil resources and the oil reserves in the region.
In fact, Ralph, displacing the British, who had it earlier set up in a relationship with the House of Saud.
Yes, and every single administration, every single administration of the United States, its entire enforcement apparatus linked to maintaining hegemony of the Saudi royal family, but all the while contemplating the day when it would be necessary to displace them and have direct military seizure of the oil itself.
Now, this is something that was discussed extensively by Ralph in Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, which was published at the time of the first Gulf War and is familiar to many of you WBAI listeners. Ralph?
Well, since 1964, as I describe in Iraq and Kuwait, A History Suppressed, every single United States administration has prepared for direct seizure of Arab oil. And indeed, Robert Tucker, in his commentary article in January 1975, Oil, the Issue of American Intervention, without intervention, there is the distinct prospect of an economic and political disaster bearing more than a superficial resemblance to that of the 1930s. And indeed, he identifies on behalf of the Pentagon and the administrations that had preceded him and were to succeed what is called the Arab shoreline of the Gulf and the Metropole, a new El Dorado awaiting its conquistadors, unquote. The area that requires our securing its control is the coastal region around Qatar, extending into Saudi Arabia, and indeed in the interior of Mesopotamia and Iraq, with no substantial centers of population of significance to impede us, its effective control not bearing remote comparison with our experience in Vietnam. Recently, as recently as January 22, 2004, Harper magazine reissued online a salient article in 1975 reflecting Pentagon thinking and that of the Defense Intelligence Agency called Seizing Arab Oil. The author, Miles Ignotis, is in fact a pseudonym for Edward Luttwak, long associated not just with American intelligence and the Defense Intelligence Agency, but with strong links to the Mossad and the Israeli state, and indeed to the formation of a policy that was called a strategy for the 1980s by Oded Yinon, a Mossad operative who contrived to devise a policy for imperialism for the subsequent years in the aftermath of the late 70s, namely the fragmentation of each Arab state in its turn through preemptive strikes and specifically facilitating the breaking up of Saudi Arabia and the securing of the eastern part of Arabia with its oil reserves and fragmenting that country, as would be each Arab nation, Middle Eastern nation, in its turn. We developed, wrote Miles Ignotis in Harper's in 1975, the rapid deployment and strike scenario. The 82nd Division, strengthened by air cavalry battalions, embarking on giant C-5 and C-41 jet transports, refueling at Israeli bases, dropping parachute troopers at key Saudi oil fields, installations, and airports, escort provided by Phantom fighters based on Israeli fields and aboard carriers in the Arabian Sea. The airborne divisions paving the way for large marine contingents and special forces who arrive 72 hours later. And indeed, this was elaborated in the London Sunday Times on February 9, 1975. Quote, "The United States National Security Council has compiled a detailed plan, a top-secret Department of Defense plan to invade Saudi Arabian oil fields, the plan codenamed Dahran Option 4, drawn up by the Pentagon, provides for the United States attacks on the oil fields of Ghawar, containing 40% of the world's known oil reserves. And this elaborated plan, now recently released again, has been virtually a blueprint of administration designs every administration since. In August 1975, Oil Fields as Military Objectives, a feasibility study published jointly by Colonel John Collins, senior specialist in national defense, 18 years of planning, contingency planning for the Pentagon, together with the House Committee on International Relations, a plan for a general location of the oil reserves of the region for the purpose of direct intervention, facilitated on August 25, 1977, when President Carter issued a secret presidential directive, PD-18, calling for the preparation of an immediate strike force of multiple divisions capable of, quote, rapid intervention in the Middle East and in the oil-producing areas of the Gulf and the adjacent area. June 4, 1978, Admiral Thomas Moore, chairperson of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, calling for the deployment of air carriers to the eastern African littoral and the Arabian Sea for direct military intervention. By late 1978, a comprehensive study prepared by the Brookings Institution, a detailed analysis of U.S. military intervention and seizure of the oil of the Middle East. By 1979, Lawrence Mosher, what military people call the U.S. 100,000-man quick strike force consisting of multiple divisions rapidly deployable anywhere by air. We have to prepare the ground for this intervention. Quote, we need a real boogeyman to come in and have to be stopped before we can talk of using the quick strike force and sell this to the public. It may turn out that the boogeyman will not be defined the same in Arabic as in English. Every subsequent administration, every subsequent national security apparatus, which has constant overlap between nominal Republican and Democratic administrations. These are the same individuals who go from CIA to counterintelligence to national security agency, from one administration to the other. Nowhere does Michael Moore address this reality. Nowhere does this film address the fact that the Saudis have been targeted for destabilization. We did two concentrated programs on setting up the Saudis and taking out the Saudis. Instructively, all of the events of 9/11 are ascribed to Saudi Arabia. The Saudis did it. Michael Moore interviews Richard Clark, who has broken with the Bush administration. Why? Because they attacked Iraq instead of Afghanistan, and because they have not targeted the Saudis. The movie evoking the corruption of the Bush family, their ties to Saudi oil money, as if the Democratic administrations that have proceeded to present these plans have not been equally involved with the banking and the oil facilitation of the Saudi royals, to the exact and same degree, as if the Carlyle Group itself is not replete with Democratic Party functionaries and figures funded by the same types of people. The apparatus of the Carlyle Group extends throughout the Democratic Party through Jackson Stevens.
Ralph, I'll go into that momentarily, but what Michael Moore makes us seem as if the oil interests disappear during the Democratic Party administrations, as if the military-industrial complex disappears, as if the war machine disappears, when in fact it was Bill Clinton who invaded the Balkans and continued with the most horrendous boycott and destruction of Iraq that led to the murder of more Iraqis than the actual devastating bombardment of the Bush administration.
Well, the UN...
The embargo, the UN-sanctioned embargo, and also the breakup of ex-Yugoslavia and the capture of the Balkan states, as well the entire plans for the Unocal pipeline and the pipeline to bring the Caspian oil down towards port access with a pipeline through Afghanistan. All those negotiations took place during the Clinton administration.
Well, they were in fact in preparation since the 70s. And they were serviced by the ideological construct that was provided by the Mossad and the Israelis, and particularly the Likud, with Benjamin Netanyahu coordinating the conferences on the terror menace, which George Bush was participating in, which James Baker and George Shultz was participating in, which each Democratic Party administration lent its national security apparatus to facilitate as well. What Michael Moore is doing here is fathering upon the Bushes alone a policy that is pervasive throughout the entire ruling class in the United States.
And I'd like to remind our listeners that setting up the Saudis and taking out the Saudis is available on our archive. They were the September 23rd and September 30th, 2003 programs. As well, you might want to listen once again to Crony Capitalism, the three-part series that aired both in 2002 and 2003 in July of those years, and they're available on our archive. In fact, Michael Moore goes even further than Laurent Muroak. People will remember we discussed the PowerPoint presentation before the Defense Policy Board, May July 10th, 2002, entitled Taking Saudi Out of Arabia, and calling Saudi Arabia the strategic pivot and declaring directly that the kingdom, the House of Saud, was an enemy of the United States, an enemy that must be attacked directly. And we have Michael Moore stating, the Bush family thinking, quote, what is best for the Saudis, not what is best for you. Now, not what is best for you is characteristic of both the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. And he definitely lets the Democratic Party off light, because what Michael Moore is doing, and doing directly, and has stated openly, is beat Bush, and has come forward to state Kerry is a man of integrity. And in fact, he went so far to say that John Kerry, when he was asked by people who were listening in on the MoveOn hookup across the country at the time when the film first opened and people were allowed to ask questions of Michael Moore cross country, he said that the difference between Bush and Kerry is that Kerry wouldn't send us to war unless he had a good reason to do it. In fact, that has not been the case for Democrats or Republicans. Each are equally responsible for wars, imperial wars throughout the world. It was, as everyone will remember, Lyndon Johnson in Vietnam.
Well, in particular to what the scenario is in the film 9/11, the Saudis are the culprits. The family of Osama bin Laden allowed to fly out of the United States. The hijackers not pursued. And in particular, what Michael Moore seeks to do is to say and to state, as he interviews Richard Clark, as he interviews the director of counterterrorism for the Federal Bureau of Investigation, the Bush administration did not go after the terrorists, in spite of the fact that Osama bin Laden blew up the coal and blew up the embassies in Nairobi and in Dar es Salaam and blew up the World Trade Center in 1993. It's a little bit bizarre, actually, when you consider it, that the coal and the Nairobi embassies and the 1993 events occurred during Democratic administrations of Clinton. On the basis of what Michael Moore is presenting to us, the crime of the Bushes is no less that of the Clintons in not declaring all-out war on Afghanistan. What does he do? He quotes Richard Clark as stating, why, there are only 11,000 troops that were sent to Afghanistan. There are more than 11,000 police in New York City.
Michael Moore comments on that.
What are the political implications and direct statements that flow from this for the understanding of our audience that is treated to the corruption of the Bush family and of George Bush in particular, with his company Harkin Energy and Arbusto morphing into the Carlyle Group, the figure of James Bath, who is blocked out because James Bath is blocked out of the documents that not only implicate the Bush family with the facilitating of Saudi money into their oil companies and those of George Bush, the president, but the fact that that James Bath was facilitating this on behalf of the Osama bin Laden family interests, and indeed that's true. But what is also and equally true is that all of that proceeds not only with respect to the Bushes, but with respect to both and all administrations, both meaning Clinton and Bush. Jackson Stevens is the principal funding figure for the Clintons throughout Arkansas and for Bush as well. Jackson Stevens is not only involved in the preparing of the Saudi money into the Bush oil companies, but indeed for facilitating the Democratic Party's participation in all of those institutions. If we look carefully at the figures who are involved here, William Crowe, Admiral William Crowe, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff under Reagan, and then for William Clinton, and then the ambassador to London, turns out to be the controlling figure in a company called Bioport. Bioport is the company that makes the anthrax vaccine. Bioport is the company that is indeed linked not just to Carlyle, but to the pharmaceutical interests of Rumsfeld and of the Carlyle Group itself. And indeed, the Bioport of William Crowe winds up facilitating the transfer of anthrax vaccine to Porton Downs, the privatized company in Great Britain that deals with manufacturing deadly vaccine in various farms, including the Ames modality. All of this is linked to Carlyle and to Bioport and to the Democrats and to the Republicans equally. Nowhere does this manifest itself in the demonization of the Bush family alone in relation to these realities.
Well, Ralph, in show after show, we stripped away the fiction regarding the bombings of the embassies in Nairobi. And I refer people to our Target Africa programs of last August, as well as many of our other shows. But to return again to the official fiction of Michael Moore that the U.S. was negligent and allowed Saudis, 142 Saudis, including 24 members of the bin Laden family, to fly out of the United States shortly after the days of 9/11. In Newsweek, Michael Isikoff and Mark Hosenball, in their article More Distortions from Michael Moore, mention this. Much has already been written about these flights, especially the film's implication that figures with possible knowledge of the terrorist attacks were allowed to leave the country without adequate FBI screening, a notion that has been essentially rejected by the 9/11 Commission. The 9/11 Commission, this is the official commission, found that the FBI screened the Saudi passengers, ran their names through federal databases, interviewed 30 of them, asked many of them detailed questions. Nobody of interest to the FBI with regard to 9/11 investigation was allowed to leave the country, the commission stated. And what's most interesting about this is Isikoff states, quote, "It was Richard Clark, the counterterrorism czar, who was a holdover from the Clinton administration and is soon turned into a fierce Bush critic. It was Clark who testified that he gave the green light to the Saudis leaving." Quote, "I thought the flights were correct," Clark told ABC News last week. "The Saudis had reasonable fear," he stated, "that they might be the subject of vigilante attacks in the United States after 9/11. And there is no evidence, I repeat here, Clark himself stated, there is no evidence even to this date that any of the people who left on those flights were people of interest to the FBI.
Well, more particularly here, what Michael Moore chooses not to allow us to know is that the bombing of the Kohl, as was documented by Michael Gillespie and in Middle Eastern Report and in other places, was carried out with a particular fingerprint explosive exclusive to the Israeli and the United States arsenals. That the blowing up of the embassy at Nairobi, as the San Francisco Chronicle documented and as we have so often cited on Taking Aim, is the work of a high-level FBI operative overseeing this operation who had been not only long established with the Central Intelligence Agency and the FBI, but who had been actually assigned to train the bodyguards of Osama bin Laden himself. Osama bin Laden has often been held out as the demonic figure who was preparing from caves in Afghanistan, and now under the complete run on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan, the inevitable massive attacks that we're being promised every other day and on the basis of which the 2004 elections are to be canceled. Osama bin Laden from his cave in Afghanistan. Talk about a false flag operation. Not a scintilla of evidence to associate this particular demonic figure with these various events. Every single tape and video ascribed to him when examined breaks down as a scissors and paste job. The only established, elaborated statement from this figure appeared on the BBC and Umat in Pakistan, as we have so often cited, in which Osama bin Laden stated that he and his associates, long funded by the United States, have absolutely nothing to do with the events of 9/11, which, as he states in his long interview, is forbidden to his religious associates and their principals. You do not attack civilians. We do not have a quarrel with the population of the United States. We are not involved in these actions. It is an internal operation of the intelligence agencies and the Israeli Mossad. It is demonizing Islam, and it is demonizing those of us who oppose the policies of the United States. It is their own event. It is to them that you must look for responsibility, for they have their excuse and their pretext, he elaborates in Umat, for doing what they've been planning for decades. An articulate, documented, clear, and unassailable analysis by Osama bin Laden of the actual dynamics of the false flag operation, which is 9/11. And that is the fundamental weakness of this film. For all its demonstration of the corruption and venality of the Bush family and their ties to Saudi oil money, the gravamen of this is that because of those corrupt ties to oil money, the Bushes are weak in going after the terrorists, both at home and abroad. Indeed, constantly, the theme is evoked that the Bush administration is shorting us on homeland security, that they are not beefing up the security required to go after the terrorists. And the terrorists are who? The terrorists are, in fact, the United States authorities themselves in their false flag operation, which Michael Moore obscures and conceals.
Ralph, Michael Moore buys into the new myth that is being promoted by Kerry and the Democratic Party as they, what we consider the one big property party. In other words, the Democratic Party moving to the right of the Republican Party as it looks to find its niche. And that is the myth of the United States is too dependent upon foreign oil, when in fact it is the United States, the imperium of the United States, that has hegemony over most of the world's resources.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener supported and non-commercial.
With the exploitation and control and domination of the peoples of Africa, so it is with the peoples of Arabia. And in fact, it is the U.S. corporations, whether it is Chevron or Texaco, with the oil interests directly, or Goldman Sachs, Citigroup, or Deutsche Bank, or Fluor Daniels and Bechtel, which has built most of Saudi Arabia, that benefit from these relationships. And that is where the real wealth, the wealth of Saudi Arabia, the propping up of the feudal, the tiny feudal oligarchy of Saudi Arabia, and throughout the Arab East, with Bahrain and Kuwait and Djibouti, all of these throughout the Horn of Africa, throughout the Arab East, the propping up of feudal families in order to prevent the realization of the democratic expression of the peoples and the control of their resources of the peoples of the world. This is the American imperial domination, be it through Democratic Party administration or Republican Party administration.
Let's look at the continuity here. The Asia Times, in an important article by Ashraf Fahim, John Kerry's sucker powder, Saudi punch. John Kerry, May 27th, speech in Seattle. Saudi Arabia has to be targeted if we are serious about energy independence. Yes, ma'am.
Ralph, before you do so, let's tell everybody that this is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen, and you're listening on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York and on the internet at www.wbai.org. Sorry to interrupt you, Ralph.
This is John Kerry on May 27th. If we are serious about our energy independence, we must finally be serious about confronting Saudi Arabia that finances and provides the ideological support for Al-Qaeda and all the other terrorist groups, states Kerry. And indeed, he promotes a program of tough financial sanctions and for no longer doing business with Saudi Arabia, unquote. This is Kerry on May 27th. Indeed, he offers support for the analysis of a book by Dor Gold, the chief advisor Ariel Sharon, called Hatred's Kingdom and Sleeping with the Devil, by former Central Intelligence Agency operative Robert Baer, in which the Saudis are set up for removal. Quote, the Saudi regime openly and enthusiastically supports the Palestinian terrorist groups and Hamas, and John Kerry supports George Bush explicitly in his speech for his support of Ariel Sharon, for the wall that cuts across the Bantustan of the West Bank. He, John Kerry, calls for support for the policy of assassination of Palestinian leaders and of the, quote, terror leaders throughout the area of the Gaza and West Bank. John Kerry, indeed, criticizes George Bush from the right for not taking direct steps to remove the Saudi royals. Saudi Arabia is targeted as president. I will not allow America to be held hostage to Saudi oil, John Kerry states. We will unleash American ingenuity and we will meet this challenge. The Saudis keep $1 trillion in U.S. banks and another trillion on the stock market, writes Bear in the Atlantic Monthly, providing the wherewithal for Kerry's policies. Kerry's remarks on May 27th, the truth is that we have a deep and inescapable energy requirement, and this requires us to look at and deal with the Saudis. This is unmistakable here. What the Bush administration has failed to do from the point of view of the neocons, no less than the Democrats, is to directly and immediately dislodge the Saudis. What is required to invade Saudi Arabia, as has been planned since the 1970s? A larger army. Senator Hillary Clinton and Lindsey Graham, the Republican of South Carolina, call for a larger U.S. military on an urgent and immediate basis. And this, as reported by CNN, as the predicate for the policy of Kerry. Not quite a dream team, writes Laura Flanders, with respect to the people who are going to be facilitating this policy. Let's take a brief look again at who they are. The presumptive national security advisor to John Kerry, the equivalent of Condoleezza Rice, who is a former advisor of Clinton on Caspian Energy, was the instrumental figure in pushing through the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan oil pipeline with direct access to Caspian Sea oil, representing a consortium of oil companies, including BP, Unocal, and Amerada Hess. Paradoxically, this whole pipeline plan, which required direct military intervention, embraced not just Dick Cheney and James Baker, but James Baker's law firm, Baker Botts, representing British Petroleum, and Dick Cheney's Halliburton, all tied to the Morningstar program. As a member of the board of directors, Condoleezza Rice, along with Morningstar, facilitated Chevron's deal to drill the Caspian's richest field in the Tengiz. As Morningstar would explain to the Harvard University Caspian Studies program, the pipeline will be used to secure Caspian Sea oil for the United States, a program sponsored by none other than Chevron, Unocal, and Amerada Hess. And who are the other key figures in the Kerry Foreign Policy Group? Why, Rand Beers. Rand Beers, who was the chief counter-terrorist advisor to the current administration of George Bush, responsible for the color coding of terror terror threats. Rand Beers, who goes back to the Reagan administration when he took over from Oliver North. Rand Beers, who was the public face of Clinton's program in Colombia. And he stated under oath that Colombian terrorists received their training in al-Qaeda camps in Afghanistan. John Kerry will assign Rand Beers to continue his role from Reagan to Bush Sr. to the present Bush administration in a Kerry administration. Indeed, he is slated to be the Secretary of State. This is the figure who ran the death squads in Colombia in coordination with the Colombian military, who planned the destruction of the crops of the poor peasants that were the base for the Colombian armed insurgency against the oil depredations and the role of U.S. imperialism in Colombia. And how about the next figure in Kerry's team, William Perry, the Clinton-era Secretary of Defense, who spearheaded the plan to restructure the defense industry and pushed through a government program paying military contractors to consolidate. Indeed, this figure is the paid consultant to Martin Marietta. He worked as the paid consultant before joining the Clinton administration, and as Lockheed Martin, William Perry facilitated the merger that produces the top weapons manufacturer in the United States. now morphing in with Laurel Defense and General Dynamics. And who do you think is deeply involved in all of this? Why, the Carlyle Foundation, the Carlyle Group, the very Carlyle Group that is a centerpiece of Michael Moore's film about the Saudis done it, and the Carlyle Group of Bush Sr. and Bush Jr. are the predicate of this association with the Saudis. The Carlyle Group was meeting at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Washington, D.C. on September 10th, and indeed September 11th, and watched the blowing up of the World Trade Center on their television screens that morning, all gathered around in the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, dramatically presents Michael Moore in Fahrenheit 9/11, because the Bushes are in league with the Saudis.
Ralph,
but Perry, just to finish the point, Maya, Perry, during the Bush administration, joined the board of the Boeing Corporation and joined the Carlyle Group, did William Perry, a key figure in the Carlyle Group, a key figure in United Defense, a key figure in the entire operation that involves the pharmaceutical industry as well, which takes us to William Crowe, who will be the chief of staff of a Kerry administration, we are told, from Kerry to Perry to Morningstar to Rand Beers. This is the apparatus of each administration in a ruling class dominion for which 9/11 was indeed the predicate. But not because the Saudis done it, and not because Osama bin Laden done it, but because the face of terror is to be found in the boards of directors and of the national security of corporations that profit from the national security apparatus that sustain American imperialism. And that is the reality that is obscured by this invocation of the wars against terror that focus on Iraq because of its oil riches, but which plan for ad seriatim, an escalation of the imperium, which is why the Kerry administration will call in for the conscription and the draft, which is why they call for an additional 40,000 troops, which is why they state that Saudi Arabia is the real target, which is why they state they cannot withdraw from Iraq, which is why they state they have to expand the role of U.S. military in Iraq. This is a reality that we do not obtain from Fahrenheit 9/11, when it describes all these policies of the imperium over a 30 and 40 year period to the Bush family alone.
Ralph, about Carlyle, Michael Moore neglects to inform the viewers that the Carlyle Group itself was set up in 1987 by a power broker in the Democratic Party administration of Jimmy Carter. This was David Rubenstein, a policy assistant in Jimmy Carter's administration, and he set up the Carlyle Group with two lawyer friends. He recruited soon thereafter Frank Carlucci, Ronald Reagan's defense secretary and the former deputy director of the CIA. Ralph, can say more about Carlucci.
Frank Carlucci goes back a long ways, brothers and sisters. He's not only the chairman of the board of the Carlyle Group, the very Carlyle Group that so breathlessly Michael Moore informs us is the organizing element for United Defense and for the profiteering around oil and arms industry, for which the Saudis have always been so essential. With Bandar Bush, as he calls Prince Bandar, who has been the Saudi Arabian ambassador to Washington, and who was interviewed by Larry King in the film 9/11 to show that Bush is soft on the Saudis. But indeed, Frank Carlucci was the point man for the Eisenhower administration in the murder of Patrice Lumumba. He would serve that role as well as deputy director of the Central Intelligence Agency for John F. Kennedy as well. He was, in fact, the figure who developed and promoted the career of none other than Colin Powell, the protege of Frank Carlucci. This is an apparatus of control of the military arm of imperialism, the intelligence arm of imperialism, that seeks out wherever it finds it the resources and cheap labor, and which targets any political movement or figure capable of expressing the aspiration of victim peoples to a sovereign control over their own resources and over their own national destinies.
Ralph, the managing director of the Carlyle Group, Robert Darman, D-A-R-M-A-N, was the White House budget advisor during both the Bush Sr. and the Bill Clinton administrations. The Carlyle group has involved the heavy hitters internationally. Former Prime Minister of England, John Major, the former President of the Philippines, Ramos, the one-time World Bank Treasurer, Afsane Mashiki, Keki from Southeast Asia, and the Bundestag, Bundesbank, the former German Bundesbank president Karl Otto Paul, as well as Arthur Levitt, the former chairman of the SEC, the U.S. stock market regulator. So we have here from both sides of the aisle, Democratic Party, Republican Party, as well the international power brokers involved in the Carlyle Group.
Well, let's just consider coming back again to Admiral William Crowe, who we're now being told it may become once again a Joint Chiefs of Staff for John Kerry administration. Admiral Crowe was associated with George H.W. Bush in setting up Osama bin Laden as a, quote, freedom fighter. And it is this Admiral Crowe who was on the board of directors and owns 13%, as we mentioned, of the Bioport Corporation. But oddly enough, this was at the time in Michigan that John J. Maresca, the Vice President of International Relations for Unicoal Corporation, was testifying before Congress that it was essential for both American security interests and energy interests to use every method available to it to secure the oil reserves under the Caspian Sea and to facilitate its transit through Afghanistan, no less than through the areas from Georgia through Turkey to Ceyhan. And this links the Carlyle Group to Bioport and to Port and Downs, as we have mentioned before, and it goes through the administrations of Carter to Bush to Clinton to Bush to John Kerry. Is it not clear that Fahrenheit 9/11 is offering us a superficial sampling of the evidence of collusion of a sector of the class, as if that sector is somehow divorced from its associates on boards of directors and the continuity of the national security apparatus that embraces both parties using the same people on a continuous basis?
Ralph, one thing I think we should address, and that is the Democratic Party in relationship to the election of George Bush, which my favorite part of the movie is the beginning, the part that details in great detail the fact that the members of the Congressional Black Caucus and other Congress folks tried to petition the joint session of Congress calling for a debate, and yet not one senator, not Ted Kennedy, not any senator signed on to the petition that would call into question the election of George Bush. And heading it all, overseeing it all, was the complacent Al Gore, in fact, being rather arrogant to the members of the Congressional Black Caucus.
Well, it's part of the power of this film, and I want to make clear that there's great power in Fahrenheit 9/11. There's great power in the way in which it evokes the arrogance and elitism of the Bush clique. But the as you are describing it, when Michael Moore documents the ways in which the election process was manipulated in Florida, focusing on the disenfranchisement of working class black and Hispanic voters, and notably African American, he opens the film rather dramatically with the series of congresspeople from the House, from the Black Caucus in particular, bringing the evidence of the fraudulent disenfranchisement of voters in Florida to the floor of the Senate. And there's Al Gore, the very nominal victim of this process in his capacity as president of the Senate and vice president of the United States, lame duck, taking charge of the process of disallowing a single one of these black congresspeople from the House of bringing to the Senate floor the evidence of the fraudulent manipulation of the election in Florida. But what is instructive about this is that that Gore rules out the admission of a single document of his own removal from the election process, the seizure and hijacking of the election by the Bush crowd, by stating that without a member of the Senate signing on to this documentation for its admission, it cannot be admitted. And each time the Black Caucus people from the House attempt to bring it to the floor of the Senate, Gore stands up rather arrogantly to rule them out of order. What is the inference and conclusion from this? The Democrats were wimps. The Democrats didn't have the courage to stand up to the Bush family. What an absurd premise. Instead of seeing, indeed understanding, that these are political figures in league with one another, that for them, the policies that informed the Bush administration were indeed policies with which they were in large concurrence. Instead of understanding the continuity here and demonstrating that the Democratic Party cannot challenge these processes because the disenfranchisement of black voters in Florida is a larger phenomenon across the South, and not only the South, in which every single Democratic Party administration in the South has participated and colluded. And indeed, the local officers who oversee this disenfranchisement are members of the Democratic Party. The fact that Catherine Harris and Jeb Bush are the beneficiaries today does not lessen the fact that the Democrats are up to their eyeballs in this process of disenfranchising working people, and in particular, the most oppressed sectors of the class. This is inability to look systemically at the phenomena that are being presented to us in Fahrenheit 9/11, and it translates into the images of Homeland Security. Michael Moore shows us the Lily White peace group in Fresno, California, presented in a kind of all in the family bumbling fashion of having been targeted absurdly by the Bush administration for investigation. This is the model and the example in the film of the violation of civil liberties through the Patriot Act for the purpose of invoking the necessity to go after the real terrorists.
Well, Ralph, it is the COINTELPRO, which all of us who have participated in the anti-war movement and the civil rights movement before that are familiar. But it shouldn't stop there.
Well, the point here again is that every time the question of Homeland Security is invoked with in some respects rather sophomoric ridicule on the part of Michael Moore, a little bit of kitsch in the way in which the Oregon coastline is shown to have only one cop available, and indeed for the whole state only seven to protect the entire coastline against the terrorists. And that's the failure of the Bush administration to be really interested in going after Osama bin Laden, the criminal culprit who is the mastermind of it all. Yes, this is the comic book scenario of the realities of repression that is, because the militarization of the police is well afoot. And John Kerry calls for not only 100,000 increased policemen, but for a beefing up of the Patriot Act. He says, John Kerry does it, he agrees with 95% of the Patriot Act. The 5% with which he doesn't agree, the elements don't go far enough, is the statement of John Kerry. And that is, of course, again, a reality that we do not obtain from this film. because in its powerful evocation of the ways in which the most impoverished of the working population, overwhelmingly minority and black, in neighborhoods that are devastated, are the primary targets for recruitment for the cannon fodder soldiers of for the wars in Iraq. Once again, the content of this evocation is to ascribe it to an elitist Bush family that doesn't serve. It is true members of Congress are also targeted for unwillingness to send their sons and daughters to fight in wars overseas and in Iraq. But what is the inference from this? A more equitable distribution of such obligation, implicitly the draft and conscription, is required, so that not only the poor will be targeted in a poverty draft or a poverty army. How will they ever trust us again? Says Michael Moore. Why will they be willing to serve when working people have been defending our freedom, those who least benefit from the system, defending our freedom from Osama bin Laden? The difficulty with the powerful images about the war, the difficulty with the powerful indictment of the Bush family, which is, of course, a kleptocracy and a gangster elite, is that it is selective in its ascription to a wing of the class, a particular component of the class, whose very apparatus of control is shared by the antecedent administrations, and for which the present Kerry-nominated presidency, it projects an intensification of these processes with the very individuals who have been hired by the Bush gang and who served them continuously and unfortunately well.
Ralph, the limits of liberalism. Michael Moore, solution, Pete Bush, elect John Kerry, more of the same.
And so we have here a failure to grasp, an unwillingness to comprehend, that it is the false flag operation, the category of terror itself, the rationale for imperial rule, which allows for the militarization of our police, the abrogation of our civil liberties. And it is somewhat obscene, frankly speaking, to present a bumbling middle-class white peace group in Fresno as the target of repression because they are monitored by a spy put in their midst, as if there's something new about this, while thousands of people of Arab descent and of Pakistani descent are disappearing into detention facilities without notification of their families or the entitlement to lawyers. It is obscene to suggest that this is the limit of the violation of our civil liberties and to invoke the necessity for a real war on terror and defense of homeland security. This is, in its own respect, a formula for setting us up. Because if the terror apparatus is so all-menacing, and the fault of the Bush people is they have not been conscientious enough in confronting it, we are set up, indeed, as we are being prepared to accept, that with the next contrivance, the next false flag operation, the full force of militarization of our society, with the army responsible for quarantining our citizens, for seizing control of hospitals, for seizing control of the police, for setting up real detention camps for the mass of our population, for police state America under a Democratic administration to be implemented with our presumptive acquiescence. Michael Moore evokes powerfully the corruption of the few, but not all of the few, only a section of the few. And that won't do. It's systemic, it's systematic, and what is required is mass mobilization, not selection amongst the criminals and confining ourselves to their control.
You've been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Shumman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Fahrenheit 7-11, Convenience Store Protest and the Limits of Liberalism. You can hear it again on our archive at www.takingaim.info.